and WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant, and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. It's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Fastest and dirtiest production of a two-hour program I've ever attempted. I being your curator and janitor, Max Schmid, here in the dustbin of history. Welcome. Time now for our lost episode of Gene Shepherd. And what have we got for you today? Well, from the Gary Hines collection, because it sounded good, and I just didn't have time to listen to a whole bunch of them to pick one. So we picked this one from 1962, November 13th. Why, this very day, isn't it, in history? November 13th, 1962. Army Area 2. Yeah, Army stories from Gene Shepherd to close out this week's edition of the Dustbin of History, here on WBAI New York.
In a famous advertising magazine. one which will affect your lives and does affect your lives almost every living minute of the day. Headline, Cleveland Morticians Set Radio Push in Image Building Effort. 10 one-minute institutional soft sell commercials are now rotated in the middle of the top 40 disc jockey shows. All together now, come on, sing, Walt. Rick a tick a tick a tick a ding ding ding. Rick a tick a ding 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 ding. Rick a tick a ding 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 ding. Now, wouldn't it be great if somehow, some way, somebody could soft sell us? How is your image? Seriously, friends, I asked you to stand back now at arm's length. Stand back as far as you can. Push yourself away. Stand back and look at that image. How is that image tonight? And could it stand a few 60-second soft sell, easy push spots? Hey! Friends, have you met Charles M. Watson of 2217 Avenue A, the Bronx? Charlie Watson of the ready smile, Charles Watson of a firm hand grip, and Charles Watson of the clear, piercing, unwavering eye. Yes, friends, Charles Watson is your friend. Why don't you call him up tonight and meet him? Ask about him. See him. Know him. To know him, remember, is to love him. To know Charlie is to embrace Charlie. Very hard song. It's one of the hardest songs I know. I'm very good on Semper Fidelis. And also, if you look on the cut there, Walt, you'll find Ragtime Cowboy Joe. And you see if it's on there. Do you see it there? All right, come on. We'll have one chorus of Ragtime Cowboy Joe. And tonight, before we do much else, let us salute the Cleveland Morticians, who are setting a big radio push in an image-building effort. It might be kind of hard to make death a friendly, lovable, sort of soft, easy, honest, reliable, dandling on your knee companion, but nevertheless, the Cleveland Morticians are going to try just as hard as they can. All together now, gang, you know this. This is the bridge. Rick a ding 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 a
That's a wonderful cacophony there. A ragtime cowboy! Yes. So we salute tonight the Cleveland Morticians. And now, once again, we move on to another phase of existence. I'm sorry, it's the middle of the week, and who cares anyway? I mean, what happened? Did a Cleveland mortician just call in angrily? No? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought maybe we were drawing blood. There's one now. Speaking of drawing blood, it's somebody want me to do. Hey, Walt, don't. What do you? I don't know what you're doing, but get over here now. Just you stand over there because we're having request night. Speaking of requests, reality. A guy wrote to me and said, Shepherd. Is that really you singing on that? Is that really you singing on the record? Well, yes, actually, I know that my little efforts here, but the trouble with my efforts is they're live, and everyone's used to recordings, and recordings are like mechanical little machines. There, people holler out of those things. In fact, one of my musician listener types, a friend, he wrote to me. He says, Shepherd, the handwriting is on the wall. It really is. It is on the wall, Dad, and it is there in neon letters. It's on the wall. He said, last summer, I'm standing out in a bandstand there out in Jersey, out there by Atlantic City or someplace, where they have all these live bands. And he says, Stan Kenton is there, and Stan Kenton's got this 22-piece band, and boy, they're blowing. And he says, I'm standing over about 3 feet away, seeing it's all soaking in. I'm letting the trombone sound soak into my bones, And he says, I'm letting them horns just sort of tickle around there around the edges and relax me a little there. Wah, 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 wah. You know how they go, how the Kenton bands go. They really go, Pow, 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 pow. Come on, Walt, pow, pow. That brass come in there? Oh. Listen, boy, I don't let no rest grow under my feet. Well, anyway, he says he's standing there next to the bandstand. The old band is really blowing, They just pow, pow, they're going like that. Have you ever stood really next to a real power band? It's interesting that most people today, because we live in a muted society, a real muted society, hardly anything is ever done really wild and full. There's hardly a comic who can even stand up next to Laurel and Hardy, because they really did it, When old fat stuff Hardy fell down the stairs, didn't he? Well, bloom, 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 pow, and he hit his head on the floor. He'd get up and says, now, you've done it again? Looking at Stanley. I mean, played it all the way full. And when Stanley would cry, he would cry. It was none of this inward sniffing stuff like Holden Caulfield. He cried. His old eyeballs were bobbing. Well, so we live in a muted society. So naturally, what we consider as the spokesman type for our world are the muted things. Little thin sounds like, and they're good sounds. I'm not putting them down, but they're very different, from the open, wild sounds. Little thin sounds like, Miles. I go on and on, Paul Desmond and so on. These guys play little thin horns, little thin people with little thin lapels and little thin ties and often little thin ideas, But that doesn't make any difference as long as it's thin. everyone knows that you never see in a Pepsi-Cola ad a fat guy. Fat guys are never sociables. They're always tall, thin, like 9 feet tall, with orange complexions. Well, that separates the sheep from the goats pretty well. And most of us are goats, that. We're clunking around out with the tin cans and eating Campbell soup labels and stuff. But, it's a funny thing. Have you ever stood back of a band, really, or in front of a band, a real big one? I mean, a real powerhouse band. Well, I'm this kid, and one of the first feelings I ever had like that, I'm just out of the Army, and I'm trying to scrape together a couple of kopecks. and I'm working away. They're grubbing it in the vineyard, you know, and doing these scut jobs. And one of the things I had a job for a network, which we shall, just for the use of a better name. There's no such network, but it was ABC, we'll call it. I was doing these remotes for this network. And one of the first remotes I ever did was a remote that had the Kenton band of that period on. It was a great band, you know, for the period. And I remember the scary feeling. I'm up there on that stage, and about 19,000 people, and we're feeding it coast to coast, and Kenton was moving from the west coast to the east coast, and he made a way stop somewhere in the middle, and there I was. And Kenton wasn't very well known at that time. And that night, a new singer joined the band, this girl, and she didn't have any band singing clothes. No, she didn't have her clothes or anything with her, and she joined the band that first night. She was scared to death. She sat back at the bandstand and just shook. And so, oh my, girl, boy, listen to that, man. And she said, man, listen to that. Wow, man. Pow, pow, pow. They're going like that. You know, the band goes, pow, pow, pow. And I'm standing up there, wow. And I said, and now it's coast to coast. ABC brings you the Stan Kenton Band. Boy, I'll tell you, it's all going to come out one day. Did I ever tell you that in one very shaky, terrible, rotten period in my life, I sang for a band? I sang with a band, and I never talk much about that, but I'm sitting backstage, and the band was Kenton, and of course, the girl who was singing, who had just joined the band, was June Christie. Had just joined. She had replaced Anita O'Day under cloudy circumstances, and the band was scary, you know, and it would go. And I remember, who was it? Vito Musso, I think, somebody like that. Vito Musso would stand up in the middle of that band, and that horn of his, and I'm just saying it was a lot of scary noises. Well, the point of the whole story here is that this guy wrote to me this letter, and he said, Shepherd, I'm standing next to the band, and they're making all these noises, and the sound is roaring out, and it's scaring me, you know. You hear there's a tremendous blast. And he said, the guy is standing next to me, a college kid, a real college kid type. And the guy turns to me and says, wow, you know? And I say, wow. And then suddenly the college kid lets go of the bomb. He says, man, I really would like to hear this on stereo. And the band is going, pow, pow, pow. Speaking of bombs, you got the thing in there all together. Speaking of bombs, this is WORAMNFM, New York. You have that E.T. in there, Eddie. All righty.
Hey, Ma, I got a surprise for you. Guess what?
I cooked dinner for you.
Oh,
look at that. Doesn't that look great? You know what that is? That's my lady's cheese blintzes.
And now we return once again to the world of reality. Oh, it's getting nuttier all the time. What next? Well, you know, it's a gay broth of a world we're living in. As a matter of fact, some guy called in last night. Oh yeah, we might as well get that out of the way too. The WOR Children's Christmas Fund is under full swing, and if you would like to contribute, send in your dime or two to me, old Uncle Gene here. And I'll see to it that all the dimes are put to good use. I know a couple of wonderful kids in that yard. It'll make it a great Christmas for them. Well, I'll be here till midnight. Unless Smitty hears me tonight. Well, on the subject of, I'd love to hear it in stereo. Some guy says, the trouble with you, Shepherd, obviously, is that the college kids don't recognize you're real because you're not on a record in stereo. He said, gotta come out both speakers at one time, like out of both of your ears at one time. And furthermore, it is quite obvious that I'm not a real entertainer because I don't sing. So for that reason, all together now. Yeah, I'm singing tonight. That's a great tune anyway. Yeah. Ragtime cowboy. You want me to sing some more? I'll sing, boy. I remember those great scenes of those great movies that have affected my youth. Those scenes with those white lights, you remember? With Paul Muni there wearing a black hat and he's being beat by rubber hoses and he's playing Lefty the Lip or something. Or was it Edward G. Robinson? They were saying, come on, you're gonna sing, Mac. You're gonna sing or else, come on, you guys. Come on, cut out the playing the piano there. Crying out loud. We've got union troubles and everything here. Well, you know, last night we did a little thing about the Army, as you know. And speaking of the Army, and a guy called and he says to the people who answered the phone, he says, you know, last night I relived every soggy moment of that soggy world, the Army. Well, that's true. The Army is somewhat soggy. However, that brings to mind, I wonder how many of us, have you ever had something that really bugged you, that really stuck down in your old craw? Excuse me if I'm using a Midwesternism. Do they have craws here on the East in which things get stuck? You don't get things stuck in your craw? You don't know what is it, a craw? You just heard me use it, and you don't know what is it, a craw? Well, when things get stuck in your craw, they're stuck in your craw sideways, and you never quite get them out. Don't you know what something being stuck in your craw is? Well, I'm not going to ask you then. You should know, being a good American. But have you ever had something stuck in your craw where you were part of something? You were part of a story, and you never learned the end of it? You know, I guess the only thing a writer is, or a storyteller is that he can recognize a middle, a beginning, and an end, and a resolution of the events that occur around us. Now, there are two ways to write. One way is to create your own middle, beginning, and end, and your own resolution. Pure fiction, an idealized kind of fiction that doesn't have anything to do with life at all, but it seems to have something to do with life because you use real characters. You understand what I mean? Holden Caulfield is a real character, but the things he does and the things he thinks are unreal for a kid of that age. It's just a sad fact of the case. And so if you use a real character, you can almost always get away with murder. And this is what many writers do. In fact, most writers do, because they idealize the situations and the conclusions. But I suspect that most of us, as we're living through our lives, hardly ever recognize the incidents or the situations through which we live that are really, in probably the ultimate sense, the stuff of which the great wild fiction of life itself is made. And fiction, I'm using fiction in the most classical sense here. It's a very difficult word, you know. Look up that word, fiction. You'll find it's a very difficult word to define. Most languages, and particularly the Eastern languages, have phrases that refer to that peculiar ambiguity, the difference between what you see and what actually happened. And so you get 15 people who look upon an event or live through a situation, and you will literally get 15 different sets of reality. And we don't have such a word in our language because we don't like to believe that it exists, you know. We like to believe that if you get a witness up on the stand, that what the witness says is true. We want to believe that. It makes everything a lot easier, especially hanging guys. Makes that very simple then, if you can really believe that what you see actually happened. Well, now the condition, of course, of American life is such that we want to believe that everything we see happened. It makes it much easier. But have you ever lived part way? Of course, I know you do. Everybody does. Everybody lives continually through a whole series of multiple plot lines. All kinds of plot lines that start and stop. It's like walking through a gigantic weed garden. Sometimes they grow big, long vines. Other times you find that a plot that you can come across in your life will be the size of an enormous elm tree or something. It really grows, you know. Sometimes it gets like the Grand Canyon or something, you know, and it just takes over, and that's the end of it. But I remember, and referring to the Army, a thing happened to me once in the Army that has really stuck in my craw, Jack. You're an old Army man. Jack, as an officer and a gentleman, I want you to listen to the story, because maybe you heard about this incident. I lived through part of it, and I always wondered what in the world ever really finally happened. It was a wild moment. It was like being brought right to the edge of a cliff. It was like being brought through 15 episodes of a 16-episode serial. You know what I mean? Well, I'll tell you what happened. I'm in this camp, see. Now, you, I have to give you a little preface here. The Army is very jealous about everything that it has. Really. If you bust, you know, one of the saddest things of all is to be on about an 18 hour stretch of KP. I mean, you're really sweating. I mean, you are working so hard. And you know, the worst thing about KP is that there's no point. There's no end in it, you know. You're not going to get any place in your career by doing a good job on KP. It is not a creative act. And all of us keep thinking in our world, you know, of everything we do has something to do with our well-being, that you do a good job, you know, and advances you a little bit. Let me tell you, 18 hours is 18 hours. You just work and work and work, and that's it. That's the end of it. Well, about the 15th hour, if you bust a cup, you're staggering back and you're sweating and your fatigue smell like coffee grounds. You spent 3 hours in the grease trap. And you smell to high heaven, and you've lost 24 pounds. Your mind is now a little thin line, a little red line of terrible pain. It's like a tooth that won't stop, and you just can't stand it any longer. And all of a sudden, you're carrying this great big rack of dishes. One cup, you reach for it, pow! All right. Get the same amount of charges out. Okay, come here, Mac. What's your name, Shepard? All right. What's your number? 1609846. All right. Okay, Mac. Statement of charges. Okay. All right. Take it. All right. Now get back to work, Mac. That means that not only have you worked 18 hours, you have just lost 32 cents by busting a cup, which they take out of your pay. Your P-A-Y, pay. That's true. Everything. That's a terrible thing. The statement of charges. So you really are scared of anything. If you lose that crummy little plastic razor that they give you when you get in, statement of charges, 17 cents, crummy plastic razor. Write it down, one crummy plastic razor, M1, GI, 17 cents, Mac. Go on down to the supply room, draw another one. You're guilty. Next case. Well, that's the way it goes. So every sock you've got, they count periodically. That's what's called the inspection. They get out and they count your socks. You know, they have a full field inspection. There won't be a full field inspection at 1200 on Saturday. Full field inspection including tent pegs. We will also inspect shelter halves. You will assemble on the parade ground out next to the flagpole at 1200. Dismissed. Well, that means you better have everything. Then you start scrounging. You run like mad. You go through all your stuff to make sure that you've got every little combs, you know, and the little piece of string they give you to tie your tent together and all that stuff. Oh, yeah, everything. And you spread it all out in a way on the ground, and the guy comes along with a list and checks it. Well, what you don't have, you pay for. So they're very jealous. Well, now, you got this picture. So things ain't free in the Army. Like, you think they give you things. People say, well, don't they give you shorts? Well, they're Indian givers. Let's put it that way. They don't really give anything to you. And everything you lose, if you bust a button, you know, if you rip the bottom open, you're dead. Well, so you got the picture. Well, you get scared real early in your Army life about that kind of stuff. You're very jealous about your equipment and stuff. You don't want anything to go wrong. And furthermore, the Army is almost insane about things like keeping stuff clean, you know, little things like that, or the windows got to be sparkling. Everything, it's just like that. Butt can's got to be polished. I mean, it's really, can you imagine a more degrading job than the polished butt cans on a Saturday afternoon when everybody's swinging in Red Bank and you're polishing butt cans? I mean, butt cans, Dad. So it's just this way. All right, now you got the picture. Well, We are involved. We are out in maneuvers. You got this. And this is way out in the Ozarks. And the outfit I was with was stationed at a place called Camp Crowder. which is will be famed. As a matter of fact, among servicemen, Camp Crowder stands right next to Pearl Harbor in infamy. And it does. It stands just a little to the right, I'd say, of Pearl Harbor, and a little bit left of Anzio, I would say. It's right there in with all the rest of the great national disasters. To those who lived through it, I might point out, I mean, you got everything from Rocky Mountain spotted fever to the scurvy living in Camp Crowder at one time. Oh, yeah, everything. Floods, the whole bit. Well, all right, now you got the picture. This is a rough camp, and there are 135,000 guys spread over 10 miles of red clay in the Ozark footlands. It's tough, rough country, nothing but rocks, red clay, scrubby trees, rushing yellow, brown streams that would go tearing past your pad, and Camp Crowder. Okay, you got it? Now, Camp Crowder was largely occupied at that point by a strange group of soldiers. You know, soldiers are like any other part of the population. They are divided into various racial groups, various geographical groups. They come from all over the world, all over the U.S. world, you know. They come from everywhere. And yet they tend to be together. They're not really thrown in a homogenizing tank, as you would think. So it seems at one point in your Army career, everybody around you is talking like this. Hey, Mac, who you think you are? You know, then you get that. Then you get the kind, for a long period in your career, you get the guys that go, hey, come on, Mac, why do you think you are? Come on now. Get it out, buddy. You know, then you get that group. And then you're knee-deep in guys from the Bronx for a while. You don't know why. You know, they move in schools. Like, within a grade school, they move in schools. So I'm out there, and for some ungodly reason, the camp is overrun by large numbers of strangely assorted rough types from Tennessee, Kentucky, and various other great stretches of what H.L. Mencken used to call the bourgeoisie. The redneck, the shooting, hollering, hooting redneck belt, where a big Sunday dinner is goose grease and corn chitlins, and that's the kind of world it was there for a while, and everybody had pimples and it was wild. Okay, you got it. So there's a terrible sense of being trapped. You really are trapped. And so I'm sitting there with about four or five guys one night, and. Have you ever had this experience? Parenthetically, I might say this. Undoubtedly, you've had it. That you get a job. You answer an ad someplace. And if you can remember when you were looking for work, and you get a job, and you go to this place, and they say, well, you're hired now, and here's your card, here's your time card. Now you fill out the forms, the W-2 forms here, and you get everything filled out here. Now you're okay, you're one of us. And you come to work tomorrow morning at 8. So you report at 8 o'clock, and by 8:30, you have a terrible sinking sensation in your stomach because there is a quality of madness, sadism and madness that is running through this place. You are in a loony bin, and the people are the kind. Yeah, it's a true madman's haven. And once in a while, a door will slam, and this insane nut will come out with his eyeballs popping. All right, you guys, come in here. All right, now up. The door slams, and you're sitting there, and you're getting mysterious phone calls and all that. And you know it's a dangerous place to be, and you're trapped. You don't know what to do. You don't know whether to back out. If you quit, you don't get your unemployment. You know, the whole business is lapping around your knees, and it's a real terrible, scary feeling. And then you go home, and somebody at home says, well, how was it at work? How'd you like your first day? Well, you don't want to be one of those guys that are rotten, rotten, because then they figure, well, you know, you're a lazy bum. You don't like any job. You've been doing this all your life. You don't like no job. And in the end, Charlie, it's you. You've got to be rotten. There can't all these rotten places be. And you don't want to say this. Well, I don't know. It's too early yet to tell. And all the while, there's the little things fluttering out of your stomach, and you got to face it again the next day, this insane, nutty place. Well, the danger about it is, after 6 weeks, you have become insane. Yeah, and you think that the place has leveled off. You see, what you think is that, you know, the place isn't as bad as you thought, but actually now you're developing the glint in the eye. And once in a while, you pick up the phone, you holler on the phone and slam it down. And people around you are beginning to say, you know, Charlie, I don't know why, you've changed a lot lately. You've changed for the good. Because, you see, most of them are nutty. And so it goes, you know. And so this is what happens. Well, one time I was in the Army, as I said, where I'm in this camp, and I got the note. The orders came through, and the orders said Shepherd was to get shipped to the other side of the camp. Well, I had finished this phase of training, you know, and when you finish training in the Army, a certain phase of your training, if you're training to be a specialist, they really don't know what to do with you unless there is an opening for your specialty somewhere right now. So what they do to you is just ship you to some other place in the camp and assign you to a company, and you stay there for a while. Well, old Shep, with two other guys, and we're fairly sane types, you know, we think we are. Everybody always does. I have never yet met a nut who thought he was a nut. So I'm going to go on record as saying I thought I was sane, just as like I think I am now, so I don't know. But anyway, we arrived down at this place. Well, we check in at the orderly room. It was way on the other end of camp. And it was in the most desolate, wild, rotten part of the camp. It was what they used to call Area 2. When anybody ever got sent to Area 2, there were mysterious things going on over in Area 2 all the time. And they had a big fence around it. It says, do not enter Area 2 except unless G2 special approved, stay out. You know, like a Purdue's pass, that kind of thing. So we're assigned to Area 2, and I'm sent to this company with two other guys. Well, Area 2 was scary anyway, because all the time we'd spent in this camp, you'd hear reports about Area 2. And once in a while, you'd hear coming out of Area 2 some sound, pow! Well, we knew the rifle range was the other way. And so someone would say, well, what are they doing over there in Area 2 today? And you, pow, pow. Nothing. We would hear no more about what was going on in Area 2. Well, we figured what was happening, they were taking guys out back of the latrine and executing them. That was what the rumor was, you know, that they don't mess around over there. That's the real Army, you know. Guy gets smart, they take him out, and they shoot him through the head. Pow, that's it. Well, so, little did I realize that's what was happening. Of course, it was a joke, you see, until I wound up in this wild company. So here's what happened. The three of us arrive, and this, here's the scene. We check in, we're fairly civilized, and all three of us are T5s, which means we're not privates, we are corporals. You know, and as corporals, we assume that we are to get a certain amount of respect. So, we check in, we throw our orders down on the desk, and sitting back at the desk is the first sergeant. Who is, by the way, a staff sergeant, which has bugged him already because he hasn't gotten the extra stripes, you see. He is a staff. He should have the other stripes, you know. He's just... So he says, all right, you guys. First thing, you got to know how we do stuff around here. You guys got your general orders memorized? Before you get a pass, general orders got to be memorized. Lights out at 11:30. I don't want any... Three unprintable words. I don't want any of that. And furthermore, we have a full field inspection at 1200 every Saturday. And I don't want no noise in the barracks when the lights are out. No noise in the barracks when the lights are out. Now, it is now Friday. You guys are going to expect a pass tomorrow on Saturday. Forget it. Okay? Forget it. All right? Get out. Well, we get out, we walk on the steps. We're now in the Army, see? So I look at Zinsmeister and I say, well, what do you think, Zinsmeister? He just shrugs his shoulders. I say, how about it, Gasser? That's all he says. And so we go clumping down the steps over in the direction of our barracks, which has been assigned to us, Barracks 1 and 2. So we arrive in Barracks 1 and 2, and there is a feeling in the air immediately. It's that nutty office. It is there. It is hanging like a great big fat cloud, a great big sullen cloud of DDT in the air. You can smell it. The place is crawling with human cockroaches. And not only that, you can smell, you really can, you can smell some kind of unnameable violence that's just hanging there like a little green cloud that floats over your head when you walk, and it comes out of the barracks, just comes floating out and meets in the middle of the street and washes back. Walk down. Old Shep goes in. He opens up the barracks door there. It's a screen door. Barracks 1 walks in. Looks halfway up and down the barracks there. And he sees about a third of the way down. On his left, he sees the sack that is his. They told me, you know, pick any sack. Well, the way the sacks work in the Army is they have the empty bed there, you know, with the springs. And they have the big rolled-up mattress at the end. So old Shep walks down there, and he's got his barracks bag over his back. Old Corporal Shepherd, he walks down, plunks the bag down on the thing, and a guy out of the darkness says, "What are you doing, man?" And I says, "I'm taking this sack." I look, you know, right away I'm on the muscle. "I wouldn't do that." "So what do you mean I wouldn't do it? I'm going to sleep here, Mac." "Okay." I'm among friends. So I open up my barracks bag. I take up my tin hat, put it up on the shelf. Boom. So look around in the darkness, and the guy is gone. I start emptying the junk out, you know. Shoes. I hang my stuff up one after the other. I look and see how they're doing it. I hang it up. Everything's okay. So I go cooling it out now. I go out. About 5 minutes later, there's Gasser walking around on the street. So the three of us are walking around. It's about an hour and a half after supper now, see, so it's, you know, fooling around. Go down to the club. It's now about 9 o'clock, 9:45. And the lights are yellower than they've ever been any place else. We were scared to death by now that we would be permanently assigned to this company. You never know in the Army, you know. Our orders read temporary assignment. Well, waiting shipping orders. But it's all tenuous, you know. And we arrive in this outfit, and they're all sitting around. And every guy in that outfit, let me tell you, there must have been about 300 guys. We're all sitting, if you can imagine, a 360-degree circle. Well, each guy was at a different angle from the other. There wasn't one guy that was looking at one other guy with anything but sheer hatred in his eye. Not one! Not one, I'm telling you. So we're walking through this thing, you know, into silence. And you don't hear any of that, ha, 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 oh, Mac, you know, none of this stuff. Nothing comes out of these barracks, nothing. The orderly room is like a tomb. Dead silence. So Gasser and Zinsmeister and I were kind of huddling together, you know. let's get out of the PX, huh? Got some Mars bars. Maybe they got some Milky Ways in, huh? Have a beer. Beer. So we go on down to the PX. Now, this is a sad PX. I don't know whether you know about entertainment in the Army. But entertainment consists of a wooden shack. And on the outside of the wooden shack is a little chicken wire enclosure with two picnic tables there. And a great big GI can that says, "Thrun your junk here." That means you, Mac. And they got about four yellow light bulbs that hang out of the sky. And in this wooden shack, there is a wooden counter. And behind the wooden counter, there is a corporal who has a cooler there, which is filled with soupy water, warm. And out of the soupy warm water, he gives you cans of this obscene beer. And it's even warmer than the water. So you go out and you sit there in this darkness with a yellow light bulb hanging over you, and you open the cans of this terrible beer and pretend it's good. Hi, Carl, a great beer. Well, you finish one of these, and then the biggest kick of the night is scoring a basket with your empty can in the GI thing. Now you go. Well, the next day, we wake up. Nobody says a word. We all stand out there. They're calling out roll. That's the only sound we've ever heard in this outfit. That afternoon, we go down to the orderly room. And we ask if we can get passes like we always do. "I told you guys to forget it. The first week, forget it." Smart guys. "Beat it, will you?" "No? Okay." So now we got a whole weekend yawning ahead of us. Nothing to do but fool around and scratch. So we go down for the whole weekend, you know. We go in and out and pretend like we're always having big fun buying Mars bars. We'd buy a Mars bar and we'd run out and holler, "They got Mars bars!" And then you'd eat a Mars bar and you run back in again. And so you have a can of this rotten beer and you holler. And then you pretend. You see, one of the great things in the Army is pretending you're drunk. On beer, believe me, a beer that couldn't get a guppy drunk. And you pretend it. You see, you drink one of these. Then an MP comes. "Sit up, Mac. Come on, cut out the fooling around." Then you sit up. Okay, all right. Cold stone sober in the market. So it goes like that all day long. And finally, Sunday night, we go down to the club and we eat down at the club. They have this little crummy cafeteria where they sell rubber sandwiches. So we go down there and we eat at the club. Well, we come out of the club. We start walking back down through the streets, which are about a mile away, until we get to the gate where it says entering area 2. And there's an MP there. He says, are you guys from Company A? And we said, yeah. He said, boy, you better get back to Company A fast, man, on the double. Quick. Get down there. That's an order. Now move. Well, we run with our pad. We don't know what happened. You know, we're running down there, and we arrive at the orderly room. And standing out in front of the orderly room is the staff sergeant, and he is checking everybody's pass in there. All right, Shepard, get in there fast. Get in there fast. Now move. Get going, Gasser. And he's got our passes. He's yanking everything all the way down the line. So we said, whoa, what's the matter? And we're walking through the company street, and the barracks are closed, locked. You see, the day room. The day room has burnt down. There is nothing standing there but this little pile of bricks. And in the middle of the pile of bricks is this USO upright piano. And it's all scorched. And there's our Coke machine scorched. Nothing. Smoke is coming out. We get into the barracks, we walk in, and there are these stone faces. Nothing but hate coming out of their agate marble eyes. And I said to the guy in the next bunk, what happened? None of your damn business. I said, come on, what happened? Somebody burnt down a day room. And we're sitting there on our bunks waiting, and all of a sudden it comes, all right, you guys, we're going to start the investigation at tomorrow morning, 0800. 0800. And believe me, there's going to be plenty of rear ends burnt around here, starting at 0800. That night, at 11:15, the three of us got our orders. Shipped out of that outfit, and I never heard another word. And it's been stuck down in my craw. I wonder where they went. What happened to them? Did they survive? Are they still alive? Who burnt down the day room? Who burnt down the day room? Who did it? Why?
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.
All right, we made it with minutes to spare. Gene Shepard, from This Day in History, November 13th, 1962, Army Area 2. And that's it for tonight's program. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for tuning in next week. Probably another episode of The Weird Circle, certainly another episode of The Hall of Fantasy, and of course, another lost episode of Gene Shepard, very likely from the Heinz collection, unless something strikes my fancy and I have time to work it out. I being your curator and janitor, Max Schmid, I'll be back Sunday night, 8 to 10, for the Golden Age of Radio, and right back here next, well, Wednesday night, I think it is, at midnight. Thursday morning, to some, the dustbin of history. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. So long, gang.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. Well, I'm...